This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, home of Space Camp. And I don't have to tell those of you in the audience today that Huntsville is tornado country. And while Dixie Alley may not be quite as famous as its cousin Tornado Alley up and down the Great Plains, Dixie Alley has many more killer tornadoes, especially long-track tornadoes and tornadoes that strike at night. Maybe you didn't know that. I certainly did. It was interesting to learn that. Of course, it's notoriously hard to predict where and when tornadoes will form, but fine-grained lightning data may actually boost our lead time for tornado warnings. But to do that, you got to know where the lightning is. And that goes way beyond hearing the thunder and counting to five or something like that and then saying it's about a mile away. You need a weather detector like Philip Bitzer. He's an assistant professor of atmospheric science at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Have we solved the question yet of what lightning is, how it starts? Because people think that we know this kind of stuff.
Short answer, no. How about that?
We don't know.
We don't know how lightning starts yet. That's an open question in lightning physics, actually. There's a couple of theories floating out there, but we're just not quite sure yet. There's a couple of theories that we have. Each have a couple of shortcomings, but one thing that we're doing is really developing new and better instrumentation to get a better handle on that.
That's interesting. So how do we measure lightning? You know, when we see the flash, you know, we count to five and it's a mile away, right? How do we know where it is? Because that's really what you need to know.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It wasn't that long ago that the way we would count lightning is the number of thunder days we got during the year. Basically, did somebody hear thunder that day? We've gotten a lot better since then. In the last 20 years or so, we've gotten really good at detecting and measuring lightning. We can do it from ground. There's certainly ground-based sensors both here in Huntsville and other local areas around the country and around the world for that matter. There are longer range networks. You can measure lightning in an airplane. And what we're really proud of is being able to measure lightning from space.
From space?
From space. We can actually see the light from lightning. It's right there in the name, lightning. We can actually detect the light from space. And that's something that we're really proud of what we do here in Huntsville. We've developed several sensors that have gone into space and are in space to actually detect lightning.
And that's their job. That's part of something else. Their job is to detect lightning.
That's absolutely right. It's a basic CCD, almost like what you would have in your camera. And we're actually looking down on the tops of clouds and detecting the light from lightning. And that's, you know, you do that at night when everything's pretty dark and lightning is pretty bright. That's relatively straightforward. I should say that detecting lightning from space is not straightforward in any sense.
Right.
But certainly it's very difficult during the day. If you're looking down from space, you see the tops of clouds. Clouds are very, very bright. So to pick out the lightning signal on top of that takes a little bit of care, but we've been able to develop a technique to do that, and we do that very well. Very high detection efficiency, as we like to say in the biz. But we see a lot of the lightning.
And you take video of it, high-speed video.
We do, and we do that from ground. So that's one of the things we do. We like to do measurements from space, in the cloud and on the ground, and try to do them as simultaneously as we can to really get a much better picture of what lightning is doing.
Well, let's look at some of the videos of slow motion video of lightning, because it's a lot more complex and really a lot more fascinating than we think it is. First of all, it comes down in branches. It's not one giant strike, is it?
Correct. You know, when we see lightning and when we sit outside and watch a thunderstorm, we see the big bright part of a lightning flash. There are so many more intricate processes that go on and so many more interesting physics that goes on in a lightning flash. And so what you see is actually coming down from the top of a cloud, the sort of plasma channel, we call it a leader, again, in the biz, that actually comes down, and they're usually highly branched as they come down out of the cloud and get near the ground. As these things get near the ground, you usually see something that will come up from the bottom, and then you get a connection. And when that happens, current flows, and you get the big bright flash that we're all familiar with.
So is the current coming from the ground up to the cloud? Is that the big bright flash?
That's a good, yes, yes.
Wow.
So a lot of times people ask, does lightning go up or down? And my answer is always, yes, it does. there's a real dim part that comes out of the cloud. You cannot resolve it with your naked eye. But the current in a lightning flash that we all are familiar with actually travels up the channel. So lightning goes up and down.
Wow. I'm more educated already.
There you go.
is there something called a bolt from the blue? We've heard that. Is that really possible?
Absolutely. So it doesn't have to be raining where you are for lightning to come down. And that's, you know, that's one of the big things with lightning safety is try to let folks know this. It doesn't have to be raining overhead for lightning to actually strike where you are. We have flashes that we've seen that will initiate in the cloud that's 60 miles away from you and produce a bolt where you are. So these are particularly dangerous types of flashes.
That is dangerous.
Very dangerous.
You don't see it.
Correct. Absolutely.
What is heat lightning? Is that, you know, we're at sun, it's hot in the summer. It's just lightning.
Yeah, so heat lightning is usually during the summer. And what that actually is lightning that just happens so far away, you don't hear the thunder. So you're actually seeing reflection probably off the bottom of clouds, or it's just lightning that's really, really far away. So there's nothing terribly special about heat lightning, but it's got a fancy term.
Are we able now, with all your satellite imaging and slow motion, trying to understand more about lightning, can we predict the storm movements any better and give us more time to take shelter or get out of the way?
Yeah, so certainly the lightning instrumentation has come a long way, and we're able to start to be able to really get at that. One thing that we're really excited about is an instrument we're going to put in space in geostationary orbit. That's really exciting to go that far up to measure lightning, and we'll be able to watch these lightning storms evolve and really see the dynamics that go on with a lightning flash.
And how much time
lightning
can you,
flashes.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, can you tell where tornadoes are coming from, like lightning? Yeah. That'll help you get out of the way?
Or? Yeah. So one thing that we've seen at some of the research that we've done is that it turns out that if you watch the lightning activity and you start to see an uptick in the lightning, we'll see severe weather be produced after that. So it's not just tornadoes. It's also damaging wind and hail. It's just severe weather in general. We actually see this sort of jump in lightning activity, usually prior to it manifesting at the ground. And some of the work that we've shown is that by incorporating lightning data with everything else the meteorologists use, we can actually improve lead time. We can decrease false alarm rate, so number of warnings that don't actually produce anything, and increase the probability of detection, whether or not we actually saw something.
Because if you can just give somebody just a minute more,
every minute saves another life or lives.
You get to the shelter, the basement, get out of the way.
Absolutely.
That minute is a long time. Actually.
Absolutely. And that's why we're excited about the geostationary lightning mapper, the GLM, as we like to call it, is we'll be able to see more lightning over a larger area than we ever have before, including out over the oceans.
Is there something surprising that you've learned about lightning that even surprised you, someone who studies it?
Every time I look at one of these videos, we see something new and different and exciting. That's what makes studying lightning so exciting. There are so many open questions still and so many great science going on. Initiation is a great one. How do we get started? How does lightning even get started? Why does it travel in the manner that it does? Why does it branch out so much? Now, these are all really open questions for the lightning physics community. That's what makes something so exciting about that.
Yeah, we were looking at ground strikes, right?
Correct.
But lightning goes from cloud to cloud. Is that different? Is that a different kind of lightning? Or?
So that's actually a good question. So first of all, we think of lightning, we see this nice bolt coming to ground. Over the United States, 3 times as much lightning is actually in cloud. So that's a huge amount of lightning that you don't see in a traditional sense. So some of the physics questions behind that are still, again, they're very open questions for us. It's harder to see that intercloud lightning, which makes it a little bit more difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. But some of the new instruments that we've developed, we've really been able to understand things a little bit better. There are similarities, certainly, between cloud to ground and intercloud, like we'd like to say.
One of the things people always ask, they're out in the storm, they're driving in their car. Am I really safer in my car? Does my car, the tires on my car, the rubber, do they protect me from the lightning? Or is that a myth?
So I should start off by saying it's in my lightning contract to say, if your lightning's happening outside, get indoors. That's the number first.
We got that out of the way. Okay.
First thing for safety, okay. Get indoors. But if your car is struck by lightning, you are safe inside of it if it's a metal car. And it's not the tires that protect you. And I always like to tell people, lightning's already traveled a couple miles from the cloud to your car. Another couple inches of tire isn't going to stop it. So it's actually the metal car. It acts as what we call like a Faraday cage. And so that the radiation and the current stays on the outside. So you're safe inside as long as you don't stick your arms outside the window or touching the outside of the car.
Huh. So I'm going to give you the blank check question I give a lot of scientists I talk to. If you had a blank check and you could spend any amount of money, and scientists love this because they don't have to really get the money, what would you spend it on? What kind of instrumentation or something that you could use that you don't have now? What would you like to have?
That's an excellent question.
Don't forget, Noah's listening now.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. Hello, funding agencies.
What don't you know about lightning that would...
So one thing we'd really like to be able to do is really get inside of a cloud, what we call in situ measurements, in the cloud measurements of the different types of parameters that occur when lightning happens. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to do that right now. A thunderstorm is a very dynamic environment, very difficult environment to take measurements in. But if I had an infinite amount of money, I would love to be able to develop an instrument to get in the cloud to really look at what's going on very close to the lightning.
Sort of floating in there and staying.
Absolutely.
Wow, that would be good.
Absolutely.
Maybe a drone.
How about that?
How one of those drones. Some kid will come up with a new kind of drone.
We've done balloons before. Drones are the next big step.
All right. We're going to watch for that.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that, Phil.
Sounds good.
Phil Bitzer is Assistant Professor of Atmospheric Science at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I don't know about you, but when I imagine what it would be like to be an archaeologist, it's a little something like this. Ah, yes, who could forget Indiana Jones running from that gigantic boulder in Raiders of the Lost Ark? But of course, for my next guest, the reality is often closer to this. She's sitting at her computer terminal. That's archaeologist and Egyptologist Sarah Parkak sitting at her computer. And now, it might look like this is just another desk job, but consider this. From that desk, Professor Parkak has discovered no less than 1,000 Egyptian tombs, 3,000 buried settlements, and 17 potential pyramid sites. So she did it using a tool that's even more powerful than Indy's bullwhip. She did it with satellites. She's here to talk about it. Sarah Parkak is National Geographic Fellow, Director of the Laboratory for Global Observation, University of Alabama at Birmingham. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Someone, little birdie, told me that even though you're sitting at your desk there, you still have an Indy hat nearby. Is that right?
Guilty as charged.
How about a bullwhip? Any bullwhip?
No comment.
I knew that you were a big Indiana Jones fan from having you on the show before. How much does being an Egyptologist have to do with being a fan of the films?
It has everything to do with the films. I'm very much a child of the 80s, and Indiana Jones was one of my favorite movies to have rented when I was a kid. I mean, my Twitter hashtag is Indy from Space, so I owe a lot to those movies.
Indy from Space. So what does space have to do with archaeology?
So, you know, in the old days and even today, you know, the best way to find things is on the ground, or so we think. And it's a new age of archaeology. Now we are using satellite images from hundreds of miles in space. We're able to look down and see and map things that we never even knew existed.
Wow. And what kind of resolution can you get with the satellite?
The resolution is incredible. The resolution now is as good as 0.3 meters or 10 inches. The image that you're looking at right now is at the pyramids of Giza, and there are these little shadowy figures that you're seeing from hundreds of miles in space. We can actually zoom in now and see people. It's extraordinary. The resolution keeps improving. You know, we're able to see so much now that we couldn't see before.
So little dots in that photo are people.
Yes.
Wow. One of your discoveries was the lost settlement of Tanis in Egypt. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Tanis was Egypt's capital city around 1000 BC for about 400 years. It's Egypt's largest site. It's absolutely massive. There's been a French team working there for over 100 years, and they have excavated a number of temples at Tanis. But the actual settlement of Tanis had never before been fully mapped, and that's something that we were able to do from space.
So you discovered this only because you saw it from space. People on the ground had never seen this.
That's right. So when you walk over the central part of Tanis, you can hardly see anything. It's just a large, silty area. It looks a lot like the desert.
We have a couple images from Tanis. Let's look at those. Here's the image you got from the satellite initially. Then we have an image that's after processing that shows a whole lot of stuff there.
So what you're seeing is the actual settlement plan of Tanis. From this image, you can clearly see city streets, you can see palaces, you can see administrative buildings. I mean, it looks like a modern city. And what's amazing now is that we can use this information to target excavations on the ground well in advance of any excavation seasons.
Why are we able to see the little pieces of the village there or the city there that we could not see before? What are we actually looking at?
What you're looking at are the actual foundations of ancient mud brick buildings. And over time, as the mud brick degrades, of course, you can't see it on the surface, but the mud brick actually holds moisture and is denser than the surrounding soil. So when you process the satellite imagery using different parts of the light spectrum and high-resolution space photography, you combine that all together, use computer algorithms, and we can actually draw out very subtle differences in the pixels to be able to map the buried structures.
And how old is that city?
This city is 3,000 years old.
And it's even after 3,000 years old, you can tell the difference in the moisture content?
That's right.
Wow. And how many of these places do you think are out there that are yet to be discovered?
I think we've discovered less than a fraction of a percent of not only sites in Egypt, but all over the world. I think there are millions of undiscovered archaeological sites all over the world.
Now, we've gone through in Egypt the so-called Arab Spring. Has that changed your career?
I mean, in January of 2011, when the Arab Spring started in Egypt, I had no idea how much my career would change. And I've been mapping a lot of archaeological site looting that's happened post start of the Arab Spring. So unfortunately, it has been happening. But fortunately, using high-resolution satellites, we can actually begin to quantify the scale and extent of the looting to try to stop it.
We actually have a couple of images here that we want to show you of Abusir in Egypt. So the first image is the before image. And that shows us, what are we looking at?
So what you're looking at is a flat expanse of land just south of Abusir village, about an hour south of Cairo. This is an area that archaeologists have never before explored, but it's a significant part of a very rich archaeological area.
Mm-hmm. And now we have an after image. What are we looking at?
So the before image was taken at the end of 2009. The image you're looking at now was taken in February of 2011. You see it is covered with small holes. These are looting pits. In the upper part of the image, you can actually see bulldozing marks. And what the looters have done is they've come in and they've dug these looting pits and they've actually exposed dozens and dozens of tombs and then probably taken objects from them to sell internationally.
And why is this the looting going on? What has changed?
You know, I think it's primarily an economic issue. Post-Arab Spring, unfortunately, the economy in Egypt has become less stable, and people are just desperate to be able to feed their families. Of course, the demand for antiquities on an international level seems to have also increased. So, you know, unfortunately, it is an economic issue. So I say to everyone, please visit Egypt. It will help stop looting.
If you have a question in the audience, please raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. What other parts of the world? Could you do this in the Southwest here?
Oh, yeah, you can do this all over the world. You can do this in the Southwest. Archaeologists have done incredible work in Central America using a technology flown on airplanes to see beneath dense rainforest canopy to map ancient Mayan ruins. So people are using this technology all over the world to give us completely new ideas about these incredible sites, sites like Angkor Wat, sites in Egypt, sites in South America. And this really is a new pioneering age in archaeology, and we're just simply realizing the scale of human settlement all over the world for the first time.
All right, let's go to the audience. We have a question. Yes, please.
So my question is about the different ways that you can measure to see the outlines of cities. I remember seeing on an article about how, in some cases, what was built on as the trees grew over, there was pH change and the foliage was different color because of that. And then in addition to that, are there places around the world that have never been populated, would you expect, or do you think humans have been everywhere?
So different satellites record different information in parts of the light spectrum that we as humans can't see. So this would be the near infrared, the middle infrared, the far infrared. And what those parts of the light spectrum do is they allow us to visualize key changes in vegetation, in geology, in soil, and in water content that allows us to visualize these otherwise completely invisible things. So as you mentioned, what my colleagues have done in Central America is they've looked at actual vegetation health in the near infrared that's on top of ancient Mayan ruins, and it's slightly less healthy because of the chemical composition. And as a whole, all over the world, we're constantly surprised. We think that nothing is there, but the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. You know, we really, really have to think carefully about how we're seeing things because we were everywhere in antiquity.
If you can see such great resolution and stuff that's underground, that's buried, and you can find the stuff, why do you need to dig it up anymore? I mean, if you can find it and you can see it and you make a 3D image of it and you could almost reproduce it, does that mean you don't have to go down and dig it up anymore?
Digging is the best part.
Spoken like a true indie.
ultimately, in order to get the subtle detail and to dig through the layers of dirt and actually find all of these incredible ancient bits of material culture and pottery and the detritus that show that people in the past were almost exactly like us, what the satellites do is they pinpoint exactly where to dig so we can focus on settlements or cemeteries or a palace or whatever we're interested in. There's no more random digging. We like to know exactly where to go. Take that, Indy.
I can see you really don't enjoy what you do from the way you're talking about. Question up here.
So with all of this new information coming from the satellites, has it turned into a big collaborative project, or have you essentially called dibs?
Actually, I'm very fortunate. I collaborate with colleagues of mine all over the world. I recently collaborated with colleagues in the UK. We mapped out this incredible site called Portus near Rome. I'm currently collaborating with colleagues in the UK, all over the US, in Europe, and in Egypt. This work is, by its very nature, collaborative. It's great. It's so much fun. I love showing imagery to my colleagues. We look at things. We get excited. I oftentimes get too excited and think I'm seeing things that aren't necessarily there. I need people to talk me down a bit. But collaboration is the name of the game when you're doing this kind of work. Let's face it, with thousands of sites that I've discovered and my colleagues have discovered, there's no way in a thousand lifetimes that I would ever be able to excavate at all. So I'm very careful. I share the data with my colleagues because everyone should be able to take part in this discovery process.
So there are no bad guys putting booby traps or rolling giant stones at you.
Well, the booby traps are for another time.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. This is delightful to have you here. Sarah Parkak is the National Geographic Fellow, Director of the Laboratory for Global Observation at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Good luck to you. We're going to have to take a quick break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. We won't be taking your calls today, but if you'd like to join our conversation this week, you can tweet us at SciFry or leave us a comment at sciencefriday.com. In the movie Interstellar, astronaut Cooper, played by Matthew McConaughey, blasts into interstellar space through a temporary wormhole.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system? To our galaxy. Here we go.
Controls won't work here. We're passing through the bulk. Space beyond our three dimensions.
Exciting stuff. But until we can travel through wormholes, we'll have to rely on the spacecraft we have. And in fact, we have gone interstellar. The Voyager spacecraft launched in the 1970s did cross over into the space between the stars. And that milestone only took, 36 years. How could we shave a few years off of that trip, and how might we visit Mars and beyond our galaxy in the future? My next guest dreams up answers to those questions. He's a NASA technologist at the Marshall Space Flight Center here in Huntsville, and in his spare time, he is a sci-fi writer and has co-authored the novels Rescue Mode and Back to the Moon. Les Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, what did you think of the film?
It was an awesome film. We saw it at the night before it actually opened and had a panel discussion after the movie to talk about what was real and how we might actually go to the stars.
But yeah, what could we do? What might be too science fiction?
Well, I don't want to argue with Kip Thorne. I mean, he is like way up there in terms of the theory. But what we've looked at and what I've looked at are things that are more known physics, things that seem to be possible. Nature hasn't said you can't do it. Nature's just said it's going to be really, really hard to
do. Like what?
Well, there are all kinds of ways you can do that. One of the best ways would be something using antimatter. There in the world today, we have matter, and then there are these particles of matter, which are like what we have, protons that, instead of a positive charge, have a negative charge, electrons with positive charges. And when they come in contact with regular matter, they basically annihilate and become energy. And if you could tap that energy, you could drive a starship. Now, that's kind of far out. For me, I'm going to bring it to not quite as far out, but my favorite is something called a solar sail or a laser sail, which I think if we send a probe to another star first, it'll be done using a solar sail.
You mean just like a ship sail?
Well, I mean, it looks like a ship sail, yeah. But instead of the wind, it uses sunlight. Here in the audience or wherever you are, there's light reflecting from you. And you can't feel it, but as the light reflects from you, it's pushing on you. Light doesn't have rest mass, but it has momentum. And so just think of all these little ping pong balls bouncing off of you. And if you're out in space, away from the Earth's gravity and out of the air, as that light reflects from the sail, it's going to give it a small push.
It's like that toy radiometer that goes in a
circle? Well, that's
not
actually how a radiometer works. That's a different process.
Yeah.
A lot of people bring that up as an example,
right.
But when you burrow into the physics, it's a slightly different physics there.
But there's enough pressure from the sun?
Oh, it's very small.
Yeah?
It's on the order of maybe an ounce and a half per football field of area. So it's a very, very small push. But the key is that the sun is always on, right?
Right.
And so it's a constant low thrust. And over time, you can build up a pretty high velocity. And if you augment that by flying really close to the sun, where you have a lot more light shining on your sail.
And so where would we go with something? Where would be a practical mission to use your sail?
You got to define practical when you're talking to me.
I know, you're a science fiction writer, so got to keep that in mind.
Okay. In the near term, I think we can use solar sails to send robotic probes pretty much all over the solar system.
Really?
Yeah, the Japanese are flying one now. It's called Icarus. It's flying in the inner solar system around Venus. You have to wonder if they know their Greek mythology to call it Icarus. But it was a 100% successful mission. The Planetary Society is going to be flying a sail this May. It's going to be in Earth orbit. And NASA's actually been investing in solar sails, and we have plans to fly a few in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. And how big a ship? Would it take football fields-sized sails to power these things?
Well, it depends on where you want to go.
Well, can you give me an example of where you want to go?
In the near term, I think we're talking sails that might be a few tens of meters to hundreds of meters on a side. If you want to go to the stars, really go to the stars.
Let's think big.
You got to think big. Think a sail thinner than a human hair, for those that aren't as follically challenged as I am, and the size of the state of Texas.
State of Texas?
Yeah, think about a sail that large. Now, we have no idea how to build that. I will not claim I know how to build a sail that large. But I will tell you that Mother Nature has not said it's impossible. You can look at the properties of light and what we're learning about materials and advanced carbon fiber materials, and you can see that perhaps someday we might be able to spin these things like a spider web in space. Get them to fly very, very close to the sun and maybe also push them with extra kick by big lasers and get them going fast enough that you could have a realistic trip time to the stars.
But once you get out of the solar system, you're going to lose the sun, basically.
That's right. You sure do.
So your sail, what happens to your sail?
Well, you get most of your kick in close to the sun. I mean, you have the advantage of this thing called the inverse square law, which means if you cut the distance to the sun in half, you don't get twice as much thrust, you get four times as much thrust. So if you deploy this big sail really close to the sun, get a really big kick, and on its way out of the solar system, you take a big laser, or several of them, that are getting energy from the sun, and focus that light on the sail, you can keep accelerating as it's leaving. So it goes really fast.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So as a science fiction writer, and as other science fiction writers have written, do you think that scientists, your science side, is informed by science fiction to think big and think of ideas like this as people use science fiction?
I can speak personally.
Yeah.
I decided to study physics and go to work to NASA because of Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, and Arthur C. Clarke, some of the great science fiction writers. I was in a workshop among my NASA colleagues not too long ago, and we were all asked to name the number one influence to our careers, and two words popped out, and they were Star and Trek. So, absolutely. So I was inspired by it, and that's what motivated me, and now I'm actually trying to make that happen in my science fiction writing. I try to go back, and I kind of view it as full circle. I'm now trying to get that next generation inspired.
So. Are we going to get warp speed someday?
I'm very skeptical of this whole warp drive thing.
Tell us why.
To me, I don't mind talking about things that are outlandishly difficult to engineer but are within the realm of what we know about how nature seems to work today. And warp drive is kind of outside of that. And maybe someday we don't know everything there is to know about how nature works. I hope you prove me wrong, you next generation of physicists. And come up with that, but right now I'm not counting on it.
You'll stick with a flux capacitor, but
I'll take that.
You'll take that one,
and the Mr. Fusion to go with it. That would be really good.
It's always 30 years away. Ever notice?
Yeah, I know.
Fusion
is
always 30 years away, no matter what happens. One of your books, Back to the Moon, involves a secret mission to the moon, and it uses something called air-breathing rockets. I thought that was the opposite definition of a rocket. I thought a rocket doesn't have to breathe air. How does that work?
There are different ways you can think about getting to space. And right now we primarily use rockets, but the dream of a certain aspect of the community is that you can actually offload some of that propellant, which is heavy, and maybe use oxygen from the air and essentially take an engine that lets you use your environment here in the atmosphere to accelerate and get to space. And we don't have anything that can go multiple times the speed of sound and get you to orbit at those velocities today. But in the book, we postulated that somebody finds a way to actually make it work. That's the fiction part of the science fiction, right? And the story goes from there. So it makes it reusable. And the idea is that this company found a way to do this, and they truly have a commercial airline-like process for taking people into space.
Do you think that it's going to be private people, Elon Musk, other people like that, who are going to get us to these planets?
Oh, I'm very optimistic that somebody's going to be able to do that. I think in the near term, it'll be close to Earth. It'll be the Alan Shepard kind of flights up and back.
Right.
I think we'll eventually see people taking tourist flights to the moon. And it's my hope, while commercial space is doing those things, that NASA and the other space agencies are going to that next step and sending people further out into the solar system.
How about, well, Mars is the next logical step. Do you think we will see it, you and I, in our
lifetime? Oh, I have hoped my whole life to see it. Before I came up here today, I was talking to someone about a book that was given to me by my first supervisor at NASA before he retired. And it's a collection of papers from a symposium here in Huntsville, 1964, looking about how we go to Mars and the challenges for that. And the introduction to Von Braun wrote for that volume could be read today. And the good thing is, we have taken a lot of those challenges that they didn't know how to do, and we can put a check mark by that today.
But just can
we know how to do that.
Well, okay. But we could put a check mark by it, but can we put a checkbook by it?
That's beyond me to answer. I'm hoping that things like by writing the book Rescue Mode and other things, we can keep people excited into what if.
Yeah.
And I believe we can. And I think part of it is showing relevance. I think it'll become inevitable that we take that next step to go to the planets and from there to the stars.
I hope that
Absolutely.
You are right. Thank you very much, Les, for taking time to be with us today. Les Johnson, a NASA technologist at the Marshall Space Flight Center. He's also co-author of Rescue Mode and Back to the Moon. Thanks again for
Thank
being
you.
With us today. We have to take a quick break. And playing us to the break, Huntsville's own Microwave Dave and Jim Cavender. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. We may not give the Earth's atmosphere much credit, but one of the reasons that life thrives here on Earth is that we've got that nice protective bubble, the atmosphere, shielding us from a lot of harmful radiation bouncing around space. In fact, the atmosphere's protective shield effect has been likened to that of a wall of concrete 13 feet thick. Not that it keeps everything out. Some cosmic rays do make it in, where they decay into a whole spectrum of other particles like muons. And those particles are everywhere because you have about a million of those muons, or everybody in the audience here has about a million muons passing through you every hour. My next guest, Richard Miller, studies muons, and he says there's no reason to worry. We can even use the shower of muons, he says, to our advantage. He's professor of physics at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
And as I said before, we're not taking calls today, but if you'd like, you can join our conversation this week. You can tweet us at SciFry or leave a comment at sciencefriday.com. What is a muon? It sounds like a punchline to a cow joke.
It sure does. You know? I won't tell you the joke. Chemists view the universe through the periodic table of the elements. Physicists, or at least particle physicists, view it quite differently. We separate the universe into things called quarks. Quarks make up protons and neutrons and other things that form nuclei, the elements. And then there's another group called leptons. One of those you're familiar with is an electron. You might have even heard of a neutrino before. It's also in that second group. A muon is another one of those particles, not as common, or at least not generally as known, but you can think of a muon like a big fat electron. It's about 200 times more massive than an electron. It is electrically charged, and it's produced in cosmic ray interactions in our atmosphere, in dirt, and other places throughout the solar system.
And so when we have these cosmic rays hitting our atmosphere, a shower of muons is produced?
Yep, shower of muons. Speaking about our atmosphere, cosmic ray protons, we believe they're produced in supernova. They slam into our atmosphere, and they generate a cascade of particles that propagate down to the ground. And one of the particles that can survive all the way down to the ground are these muons, high-energy muons. And like you said, about a million of them going through you roughly every hour. If you lived in Denver versus at sea level in Hawaii, you'd be getting a higher dose from those muons. Just to be clear, there are other more important things to worry about than the muons going through you right now. Smoking, ingesting, different things. But muons do provide a dose of radiation that is part of the natural dose that we all get.
Yeah. Is there anything, well, since it is kind of a radiation, we're familiar with X-rays and other kinds of radiation.
Right.
And we use them to look at things, right? We penetrate stuff. Can you use the muons to penetrate things and look at them?
We do, yeah. So they can be used in a variety of ways. In my previous life, I used them to do a form of astronomy, neutrino astronomy, where they're induced by neutrino interactions, and we can look at those in the largest detectors in the world. We're now changing that and to using them to do space archaeology. Except it's not archaeology of structures here on Earth, but it's the archaeology of the early solar system. What we're doing is developing something called muon tomography or muography. And the idea there is to go out in space, visit some of these early solar system bodies like asteroids, and we can use muography or muon tomography to study the internal structure of these objects. When muons pass through dense material, some of them are absorbed, and they'll be more likely to be absorbed in high-dense objects than low-dense objects, and we can see contrast and actually internal structure. This is very similar to what happens with a CAT scan, a medical CAT scan.
See, CAT scanning an asteroid.
CAT scanning an asteroid. The difference is a CAT scan uses X-rays, and we're using muons.
Now, I hear that muon scanning also has national security implications.
It does.
Is that right?
There are folks at Los Alamos National Lab and elsewhere who are using the same idea to look for high-density materials that someone might try to bring over the border. Those high-density materials would be things like radiological materials that we don't really want crossing into the border. And by the same token that we look for the structure in asteroids, we can look for these high-density objects inside trucks that might be crossing the border.
Mm-hmm. You used to work with a proton detector in a salt mine.
I did.
Strange place for a physics experiment.
Yes, it was actually under Lake Erie, the Morton Salt Mine.
Under Lake Erie?
Under Lake Erie, about 2,000 feet. And its original goal was to study whether protons are radioactive themselves, really telling us about the fundamental nature of the universe. We didn't find that, but we found a second life for this detector, and that was as a neutrino detector where we looked for muons that were generated in neutrino interactions coming from the backside of the Earth through the center of the Earth and up through our detector. And in fact, we did see those quite often, actually.
I remember the days of proton decay.
Yeah.
I was down to the salt in a taconite mine in Minnesota.
Great. Ah, yeah, the Sudan mine, yeah.
Never found it.
Never found it, no.
So do you have higher hopes, though, for muon imaging for either the asteroids or other uses?
Absolutely. Particularly for the asteroid application, all the physics details are fairly well known. What we're trying to do now is scale up the idea and make it applicable or feasible and cost-effective. We believe we have some good leads on that by studying these asteroids. We're actually, as I said, looking at the early period of the solar system and actually telling, it's going to tell us something about how the early solar system formed, how planetesimals, which ultimately became the seeds of planets, started to congregate, and ultimately how our solar system evolved to what we see today.
But it's not just taking, as you say, there's time involved here.
There is.
It takes a while to,
yeah.
So to X-ray it's or a muon 8 or whatever
that's
you call
right.
it.
It's a trade-off between the size of the detector and how much time you're willing to wait. So if we our goal is a detector that's on the order of a square meter in size, which is not crazy, but it's large, and if we had a detector like that, we would be able to do this muography of an asteroid in roughly somewhere between 3 to 6 months to get a first image of what is happening inside those asteroids.
Well, we'll wait to see what happens, yeah. Richard. Thank you. Richard Miller, professor of physics at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks for viewing with us a little
bit. Thank you so much.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're headed to the space station to take a look at the experiments conducted on board. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And last week, we talked about the International Space Station's nifty new espresso machine. Get it? Espresso machine. They also had a bulbous nose-shaped zero-gravity coffee cup, which allows astronauts to sip their drinks in zero gravity. But they are more than just sipping coffee up there. There is a microbiome experiment studying, does space change the community of bugs that live in your gut? Think about it, and then don't think about it. And experiments on how plants know to grow in the right direction, and it's not just the sunlight that we talk about here. And investigations on how your genes interact with zero gravity. Now we have the famous Kelly twins, Mark and Scott, as the test subjects. Mark is here on Earth, and Scott is up there in space for a year. They're going to be up there comparing notes with the ground. And then there's one of my favorite, the suction pants experiment, which, well, we'll talk about that with my next guest, NASA's chief scientist for the International Space Station program, Julie Robinson. She's based at Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. She came all the way here to Huntsville. Hey, to be with us today. Glad to have you. Dr. Robinson, thanks for joining us. There's so many things going on up there that we don't hear much about, except the espresso machine.
Yeah, what can I say? The press doesn't always want to cover the most exciting science. They want to cover the most popular science.
You know, when I was reading about this, some of the exciting stuff, especially how zero gravity might affect the genetics of the people up there. We had never thought about that before, did we?
Right. I mean, now we're in the age of personalized medicine now, you know. Doctors are starting to test your genes before they decide what to prescribe. It's hitting cancer therapy, all of that. And it's hitting us in space as well, because not every person is reacting to the space environment the same way. And as we start to understand that better, someday it's going to influence who we send to Mars, for example. Maybe not everybody has got the right genes to go that far and be subject to all that radiation and be alone such a long time.
Right. So we learn things that we never expected. We never expect a lot of things out of zero G, but things pop out, right?
One great example that popped out about 4 years ago was that there are some astronauts, not every astronaut, and mostly the men, not really the women, that have permanent vision loss after being in space. A lot of astronauts have some vision decline when they're on orbit, but when they come home, there's a few that never don't get better, don't recover. And what we've learned over the last 4 years is that their optic nerve is swelling, the pressure in their brain, basically the pressure of the fluids in their brain is going up. Their optic nerve swells. It compresses their eyeball so it's not round anymore. And it can cause cotton wool spots and disrupt the retina. It's this whole process. And we missed it for all these, 40 years of human spaceflight. We didn't even realize that
was going on.
Yeah,
because we used to talk about you maybe lose some calcium, your bones atrophy a little bit, but never these other kinds of.
So bone loss we've known about
for a long time, and that's one that we're actually solving. So we've had astronauts now come home from the space station that with the right level of exercise, high-intensity resistive exercise, not running on a treadmill, the right vitamin D, and the right calories, eating a fair amount of food, they come home without losing bone mass density, and that's actually an incredible achievement for mankind to get off of the planet.
I think a lot of people want to get into space here. What can we learn from the Kelly twins? What's the biggest thing that we're hoping for?
Well, you know, the thing that's really a breakthrough with the Kelly twins builds on the one-year expedition that we're doing with our Russian colleagues. So, you know, Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko, a cosmonaut, are both going to spend 1 year on the International Space Station. And we're bringing the two medical research programs of the U.S. and Russia together and doing joint experiments on things like fluid shifts, on the eye issue I just talked about. Once we had selected Scott for the one-year expedition, he and Mark came to us and said, hey, you know, don't scientists do things with twins? Aren't twins a good way to understand things? We'd love to volunteer. And that was a huge breakthrough for us because we're always pretty careful at NASA about looking at genetic data. You know, astronauts are employees. They're covered by a federal act called GINA that doesn't let you use genetic information about your employees. And so until they had come to us, we really had not started dealing with all of the ethical issues. And they were really open to having their, basically their genes sequenced, right, having people look at all of these different levels, what proteins they're making, what RNA is coming out, even their gut microbiome. We're looking at both the microbiome of the astronauts, but also the way that microbes colonize the space station as a whole. As new vehicles come up, it's one of the most closed systems in the world. Anything that gets there is going to pretty much stay there until it gets filtered out by the HEPA filters. So it makes a great laboratory for studying microbes.
Why would we have different protein expression if we're in space? What does our body think is happening that it changes gears?
Yeah. So one of the things that happens at a cellular level is there are certain cells that are responding to, say, muscle tension. If you look at your bones are always recycling themselves. If they didn't recycle themselves, they'd become brittle and they'd just break. And so there's a type of cell that actually feels the tension at a cellular level between your muscle cells and the bone and says, boy, you know, I should do some work here. I should build some bone. And if that tension isn't there, it doesn't work the same way. So really understanding that tension between the cells that chew up bone and the cells that build bone is where a lot of the focus has been on bone loss research over the last 10 years.
All right, we have a question in the audience. Let's go right here to the front. Yes, sir.
Yeah, we're talking about some of the effects of zero gravity. And to date, I guess, it's been combated primarily by extensive exercise and pharmacological approaches and things like that. But Dr. Ashton Grabel did a lot of research several years ago in using artificial gravity, and that, of course, has shown up in movies like 2001 Space Odyssey. Is there any work going on in that area nowadays?
Yeah, artificial gravity is something NASA's looked at several times over the years, and the big problem with artificial gravity is you've got to design your spacecraft system. Well, it's got two problems. One is the spacecraft system side and one is the human system side. So you've got to design your spacecraft system to work in spinning mode and to work if it breaks and isn't spinning anymore, which means the physics has to work for zero gravity and the physics has to work for spinning. And that's an engineering challenge. So that makes a spacecraft much more expensive to build. And you know how well that goes over.
Yeah.
But on the human system side, when you're spinning, if you guys think 2001 A Space Odyssey is how it would feel, you're wrong. Think Ferris wheel, think, tilt-a-whirl, because your brain and your sensory system does not like to have these Coriolis effects on your body. So if you're centrifuging around and you turn your head a little bit to the side, you're going to throw up. And so
I hate it when that happens.
So far, the idea of trying to design a 360-degree barf bag for a centrifuged astronaut was not working out so well.
Would it be possible in a large, space station or other place to grow fresh plants, the people that could eat fresh food?
So we are growing fresh plants in a little habitat called Veggie, and we just brought enough samples home. Everybody was worried about the microbiome part of that, see? So the first set we grew, the docs wouldn't let the astronauts eat them because they wanted to bring them home and make sure they were clean enough. We just got approval. So the next set that grow are okay to eat, the next lettuce.
It's going to be lettuce? What's it going to be?
I think the plan is lettuce, but yeah. We haven't confirmed that yet. So
yeah. That's not integrated into the waste system for vegetation.
No.
No.
But, the amazing thing about plants is that when you look at the genes that turn on when they're in space, they're kind of the same genes that turn on when they're water stressed.
They think there's a drought, same kind of genes that get turned on?
So, and there's a lot going on with plants because they're in space, the liquid doesn't go to the bottom of the container. So there's all of this water everywhere with air bubbles everywhere, and the roots feel like they're drowning as well. So there's a lot of work going on there to try and understand, you know, what is this stress response? And how quickly does it happen? There are even scientists that have done a lot of work on the space station. They decided to see how fast does the plant know it's in space. And so they did some work on a sounding rocket, and they were measuring electrical impulses in the cells and found it was almost instantaneous as they went up.
They knew they were in space, or they started reacting with the stress?
They started reacting. You could see the gene reactions change. The gene transcription would change.
Wow. Do we have a question in the audience? Yes, sir.
On the subject of the ISS twin study, there are some effects that can be expected, such as the calcium loss that you had mentioned earlier, but are there any effects that are less well documented that you're interested in looking at or just looking to show?
Yeah, that's a great question. Two of our biggest risks as we look ahead at going to Mars are radiation, because, you know, even on the space station, we're still partly inside the Earth's magnetosphere. So we're in a gentler environment. It's not as gentle as here on the Earth's surface, but it's a little bit gentler. And as you go on a transit to Mars, you're pretty much in open space and really exposed for a while. And so that radiation risk is one thing. A second thing we're really concerned about is what we call behavioral health and performance. And that's something that engineers aren't real comfortable with, because it's not the hard, firm, data-driven type science maybe that most engineers are comfortable with. But the fact is, if you're on a mission to Mars for 3 years and you're with a handful of other people and you're stuck with them and things get tense and things go wrong, and halfway through the mission you really wish you could quit, there's not a lot you can do about that. And so understanding how to select the right crews, how to give them the right support. They can't call home from Mars like they could from the space station. You know, on the space station, they just call their families on the satellite phone.
You know, in the early days of living, I remember when I was in Antarctica 30 years ago, in the early days of what they used to call wintering over, you couldn't leave Antarctica for 6 months either.
Right.
And they started they actually started documenting people who were going a little nutty, as they called it. You know, and there was a depression they go through and whatever. This sounds like you're in the early days of that same kind of research.
Right. And so we have studies that'll be going on that help the astronauts to assess their own state of mind. Especially, you can imagine on a Mars mission, an astronaut needs to be able to assess themselves, because they can't, the delay of communication with the ground could really interfere with getting a lot of support. You know, talking with Scott Kelly before he went up, he was really realizing this is so different than the 6 month mission he did. When he did a 6 month mission, he said at about 4 months in, he'd had the experience. He was kind of done with it, and then he just had to soldier on. And that's actually been scientifically documented. It's called the third quarter effect. It happens to marathon runners as well. You know, when you're through the first half, and then you think, oh my God, I've got right. to do this again.
You hit the wall.
And so he's really thinking actively about how is he going to deal with that in this mission. What happens, he asked me, what happens if at 4 months I feel the same way I did the last time?
But at least you can predict it now. It's sort of more of a science right. that you know what's going to happen, you know to expect it, and other people around you know that that might happen.
Right. But part of what we do on the space station is it's not just predicting the problem, it's finding a way to alleviate the problem. We call that a countermeasure. We've got to do something to get that risk down enough that we think that mission is going to be good to go.
Julie Robinson is chief scientist for the International Space Station, based at the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Julie Robinson, chief scientist for the International Space Station. You know, there are people who think that if we're going to Mars, it's a one-way trip. We should find people who are willing to go to Mars and be their last place that they go. They're not coming home. What is your view? What is NASA's view on this?
Well, I think we've
got... And there are thousands of people who are supposedly ready to do that.
And those people can do it on their own dime, but I think... It's sort of the difference between the Lewis and Clark expedition and a personal trip to Mount Everest, right? And the Lewis and Clark expedition was a government-funded expedition to gain knowledge for the benefit of the nation. And we sent them, intending them to bring all that knowledge, the samples back and all of that, so that it really served the nation, not just them as human beings to go do something cool. But an Everest expedition is generally a person raising their own money and paying for a personal experience, and they take a lot of personal risks and die. But that's not something that governments usually fund. So,
mm-hmm. Let's see if we can go to the audience. Yes, right here.
Hi, I got a question about disease on the International Space Station. Can other astronauts come up and pass like the common cold or the flu, like new astronauts coming up, bringing up food or for example, other supplies?
Yeah, we worry about that a lot. All the astronauts are in a quarantine before they launch for a period of time, hoping that we won't bring up something like the common cold, but it has happened where somebody looked pretty good when they launched and they'd looked good all along and maybe they got a, you know, an illicit kiss from one of their little kids or something like that, and they brought it up. And from the astronauts that have had colds in space, they say it's pretty miserable. The only way to clear your sinuses is to spin yourself around.
Ooh, okay. Do we worry that we might be bringing our germs to Mars if we go there, and they might run wild?
So, you know, there are folks at NASA that are sort of in charge of planetary protection, and they talk a lot about how all the things we're going to do to make sure we don't bring bacteria to Mars. But with my own background as an ecologist, I think a little more practically, and I just can't imagine that anything we send isn't going to have some bacteria on it. That's just my personal view.
Yeah, it's going to, you know, as they said in the Jurassic Park, nature will find a way.
Nature finds a way.
Jeff Goldblum's famous
line. There'll be
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we have to expect to bring something there. One of the recent experiments on the International Space Station was 3D printing in space. So you could make stuff up there instead of ordering it from Earth. Did it work well? Was it okay?
It didn't work perfectly. And in fact, some of the guys you were talking to about the coffee cup, they had predicted it wouldn't work perfectly because they're experts. You know, Mark Weisslogel is an expert in how surface tension forces of fluids dominate when you don't have gravity anymore. And so the things kind of stuck to the surface in ways we didn't expect and so forth, but we're going to work on some other materials and keep analyzing the way that the little droplets of fluid start interacting with each other. You know, when you think about the big picture, I would say 3D printing is one of the most important things we can do for becoming independent of Earth so that we can do a long-distance exploration mission, because you cannot take all the spare parts with you. And so if you're able to manufacture only the spare parts you need and any spare part you could happen to need, that makes a huge difference on the cost of a mission, the mass of a mission, and the safety of a mission. So it's really important.
Let's talk about suction pants. I'm not even going to go there. You just take the ball and run with that suction pants.
Well, so I talked about the eye issue, this idea that fluids are shifting up into the head and causing pressure that could damage the eyes. And, you know, those fluids are rising up because there's no gravity holding them down. Our bodies are adapted to be in 1G. And when astronauts we know well go up into space, they look funny to us, if you know them well. Their faces look puffy and their legs get really skinny. We call that chicken legs. So when they're wearing shorts or something like that, you go, oh man, his legs got really skinny.
I'll be looking out for that now.
Yeah,
that I know
you got to watch for it.
Yeah.
And so this is something we've known about for a long time, but all of a sudden it has a new focus because it might be causing damage to the eyes. And that changes the whole landscape. It's not just something funny anymore. It could be something really serious. Our Russian colleagues for years and years have had a countermeasure that they use before their astronauts return to Earth that they think helps them to get used to the fluids coming back down in their legs when they land. And this is called the Chibis. And it's basically a set of pants that have lower body negative pressure, which is suction, essentially. Huh. And so what we're going to do on this one-year expedition for the first time, it's a really exciting study with both Scott and Mikhail, is have them in the Russian segment using the Chibis, and then have all of the American ultrasound equipment and the tomography, the eye measurement equipment, also in the Russian segment so that we can draw the fluid down and then see, does that affect the shape of the eye? Does that affect all the eye problems that we might be observing at the time? And also, do we see the fluids actually shifting or not? So we'll be able to image the blood vessels and really see if this is an important area to pursue.
You know, this sounds like the same problem that fighter pilots had in the early days of in the 50s of supersonic planes, because the blood would rush from their head and they'd black out when they're going, you know, doing a lot of G-forces, and they had to come up with spacesuits that would push the blood
right
back up there. It's sort of the same but yeah, the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's the same set of problems. Yeah. And also, you know, pilots will do Valislava maneuvers so they don't pass out, you know, where they create some pressure in their heads to keep the blood there. Where one theory, which hasn't been proven on the eye issue, the vision issue, is that all this high-intensity resistive exercise that's protecting the astronauts' bones and has the osteoporosis research community here on Earth really interested might be contributing, because they're basically doing Valislava maneuvers when they're doing this high intensity exercise too. So that might make it worse.
Well, Dr. Robinson, I'm so glad you decided to come in from Houston to visit us.
It's always a pleasure to be here in Huntsville. It's our mission control for all the research, so it's good to be here.
Thank you. Julie Robinson is chief scientist for the International Space Station, based at the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. We won't be taking your calls today, but if you'd like to join our conversation this week, you can tweet us at SciFry or leave us a comment at sciencefriday.com. Now, here at Science Friday, we're all about the rigorous pursuit of truth through the application of the scientific method. So with that in mind, I'd like to present to you this cat video from YouTube.
So here's what's interesting about this to me. If you'll notice at the beginning of the drop, the cat is not rotating. Halfway through the drop, the cat is rotating, and then at the very end, Gigi somehow stops rotating. Newton's first law says that an object at rest will stay at rest unless acted on by an external force. I see no external forces on this cat. So what's happening here? It's not making sense to me.
In case you couldn't tell, that's not your average internet cat video. That's the beginning of a physics explanation using high-speed video and a house cat as a test subject for why cats always seem to land on their feet. And don't worry, no kitties were harmed during the making of this film. It's one of the more than 100 videos my next guest, Destin Sandlin, created since he launched Smarter Every Day, his YouTube science channel. By day, Destin's a missile flight test engineer at the Redstone Arsenal here in Huntsville. But by night, he uses a powerful high-speed camera to unpack the science behind everyday mysteries, like how tattooing works and why spaghetti snaps the way it does. Destin, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Tell us how you started making these videos.
Oh, goodness gracious. It just kind of happened. It was like a fire in my bones, and I had to do it or I would explode kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes a big mess, so I'm glad you didn't.
It does. I really like to teach, and I like to explore the world using science. And then my wife brought home a laptop with video editing software. And so I made a video called How to Light a Bonfire with Rockets, as you do.
Of course.
Yeah,
it's
of course.
The first thing I would do when I got it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I made that video, and I put it up just for some friends, and they liked it. And I don't know. I just started.
And you've had some great videos. The first one I want to show today, I think, is probably a great hit. A video called Chicken Head Tracking.
Oh, this.
Let's.
Thank you.
Let's
thank
watch
you for
a
doing
bit
this.
Of that.
It's a chicken. I got my dad a chicken for Father's Day. And I want to show you a pretty interesting method that chickens have to keep their head stable. You know, in guidance and control, you have feedback loops. And so you have to know your position and where your relative motion is going so you can compensate for it. But chickens are really good at this. So I'll show you. Watch his head stay totally stationary as I move his body. I can move his body in pretty much any direction, and his head stays rock solid in one position.
Yeah. So you're going to start right out of the gate with a chicken video. I see how this is going to go.
Well, besides the fact that everybody buys their father a chicken for Father's Day.
Yeah.
Describe what happened in the movie. People on the radio who can't see what was going on. It was quite dramatic.
Okay, so I made this video because I observed this, right? You know, we live in Alabama. Of course, you get your dad a chicken for Father's Day, right? And so I started moving the chicken around, and I had just got out of some guidance and control classes. I was working on my master's degree. And so for me, this was this really deep, intense thing, because when I would move the base of the chicken, the head of the chicken would stay still. And I noticed I could move it in any direction, and it would stay in one spot and never move.
It's like a gyroscopic head.
Exactly, like a steady cam for the chicken. It's like a personal steady cam for the chicken, exactly. And so I started thinking about this, and I'm thinking like rocket guidance and control, right? And so I make this video, and I'm like on this really deep differential equations level, and then everybody in the comments just talks about how redneck I am. And so I'm like, no, but there's this, you know, vestibular ocular reflex in the chickens. And they're like, we don't care. You're a redneck with a chicken, but it's awesome.
Is that the reason why a chicken moves its head so funny at first places when it walks?
Exactly. Exactly.
What's going on there?
Yeah. So what the chicken's doing is he'll walk by putting his head forward and then running his body in under it. And then he'll move and do it again. And so I started thinking about this, and you can actually back drive the reflex. If you put your hand in front of a chicken and just let him lock on visually with it, and then move your hand, he'll start moving his head to wherever your hand is going. So he's back driving that same reflex. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Spend a lot of time with chickens. I can see that.
I do. We actually had 3 new ones last weekend. Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, it's
but
a big
the
deal.
It was very popular. This had 3 million views.
Something like that. I don't know.
Did that change your way you approach videos, the success of this?
You know, it actually did. So I figured something out at that. That was the first video that ever went pretty big, right? And I realized that I could kind of slide a spoonful of vegetables in with the dessert at that moment in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and so I'm interested in science and science education. And so I figured out at that moment in time that if I could make it entertaining at the same time as I was educating, then I could get people to learn things that they normally don't care about.
Hmm. And, you know, and people who watch your channel now on YouTube, they know that you love these high-tech toys.
We do.
And your coolest toy, I think, is the high-speed camera. How did you get a hold of a high-speed camera, first of all?
Well, that's a good question. Well, so let's go. Can we go all the way back?
All the way back.
Let's get in the way back
machine. To fire. We'll go back to the invention of fire, yeah.
So I remember sitting in my biology class in 9th grade, which was taught by Mrs. English, and I was looking at my physics book, right? And so I was
in there.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. Yeah. So I was looking at my book, and I saw a picture by a guy named Doc Edgerton from MIT, the master of high-speed photography, right? So Doc Edgerton, he invented all these different high-speed cameras and the stroboscopic photography technique. It's amazing. I looked at a picture of a bullet going through an apple, and I said, I don't know what the heck this is, what kind of sorcery did this, but I want to learn that. And so fast forward, you know, 10 years after my bachelor's degree, and I'm interviewing for a job, and they said, yeah, so we use these high-speed cameras to test rockets. And I'm like, you don't have to pay me. I'm working here, you know? And so once I started doing that, I learned how the cameras work. I just started using them. And then I was able to get a hold of one at home. And when I did that, I made a video about pistols underwater, and it just took off from there.
And so you borrowed one to take home from work.
I did not. As a scout's honor, as a good civil servant, a government employee, I would never do that because that would be fraud, waste, and abuse.
Uh-huh. Okay. So
yes.
Okay. I'll buy that.
That's right.
Let's move on to another video that you made. This is something also you can try at home. You did this experiment in your family van your kids. Tell us what you did.
Basically, my dad called me again. This wasn't about a chicken. And he said, hey, you know, I've noticed this thing with a balloon. If I hang a balloon up in my vehicle and I drive forward, the balloon doesn't behave like a normal inertial type mass model like you would expect. It doesn't sway backwards. It actually sways forwards. And so we did this experiment with my children. And my personal goal is I want to see if I can figure out how to explain this complex concept to my 5-year-old son. And that was a challenge that I laid out for myself.
And so you had some helium balloons in your van. And normally when you have, you know, when we drive in the car and we turn right or we stop or accelerate, our bodies move back and forth.
Exactly. Like sometimes I hang my sunglasses on the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And so when I turn left, I watch my sunglasses go to the right. And then sometimes I'll get them oscillating and I figure out how to stop it. And I'll quit talking now.
Go
ahead.
No, I like that. I have to do that.
I do science when I listen to Science
Friday. I'm a little
Friday.
Stealthy geek. I'm like you, but I keep it a little quiet. Like, you know.
I understand.
I don't advertise it that much, but I'm just as interested in that kind of thing. We'll talk later, you know.
Got it. Okay. Thank
you. But this one, what happens with the helium, though, is the balloons act just the opposite of the way your body is shifting, don't they?
They do.
What's going on? Why is that?
Okay, so if you think about it, your car is a closed system, right?
Yeah.
It's like its own little, you know, nothing in, nothing out. Well, there's air in the car, and the air in the car behaves like a fluid, right? So here, I've got a water bottle in my hand right now. So if I'm holding this water bottle in the hand and I accelerate towards that end of the stage away from you, you'll notice that all the water sloshes to the back of the bottle.
Right.
Okay, so if you do it the opposite way, it'll all slosh back to that one side. So the air in the vehicle behaves just like the water in this bottle. So when you accelerate, you're pushing air to the back of the vehicle, and the air pressure, according to fluid dynamics, the air pressure in the back of the vehicle is just a little bit higher than the pressure in the forward part of the vehicle.
So it's going to push the balloon forward because it's higher pressure back there.
Well, it's actually creating flow. Uh-huh. And so what I like to, the way I like to explain it is it's pushing back, and then that helium, because it's lighter, you have a buoyancy type effect, and the helium is going forward. Does that make sense? Just like the same reason it floats.
Try it. Everybody can try this. Take some helium balloons, put them in your car, drive it around. It's
beautiful.
Counterintuitive.
It really
is. Counterintuitive. All right, we're going to learn something now, something new, because you've got a brand new episode of Smarter Every Day, and involves this bike here that you brought with you.
That's right.
This is not your average bike, right?
No. This bike, this has caused me a lot of pain, actually.
Literally?
Literally. This bike has caused me a lot of pain.
Why is that?
Well, this started a long time ago. I work at the range there at Redstone Arsenal, and I got a call from a welder down at the other end of the range, and he said, hey, Destin, I need you to come down here and ride my bike. And then he starts laughing. And when a grown man starts giggling in his coffee cup and tell you to come ride a bike, that gets weird quick, right? And so I went down there, and he had created this monstrosity. It's not a normal bicycle. Do you want
to? Yeah, let's go down. I'll take my portable mic and we'll walk down to the bike. It looks like an old Schwinn.
Yeah, pretty much. I like the style, but there's one major difference in it. When you turn the handlebar to the right, the wheel goes to the left. And when you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. So it's pretty simple, right? That makes sense.
It looks pretty simple, you know. Well, so you get on, you just have to adjust it a little bit, and you're riding immediately.
Yeah, exactly. So what you do is, you know, you just tell your brain, you know, you're the control algorithm for riding a bike. You know, it's just like riding a bike, right? Only you just change one part. So you've got this huge control algorithm, and just flip that one variable, and you're good to go, right?
Right.
Well, I've got my brother-in-law over here. Is it okay if we let him have a go at it?
Sure.
Is it acceptable?
But what's your name?
Sean.
Sean, have you ridden this bike before?
One time I tried a few months ago when he was practicing, because I got to see how awful we both were.
I don't know if we're insured for this. We'll try and see what happens. All right, so
Sean, just to make this interesting, so you see that fern over there, that green plant? I will mow your yard for the rest of the summer if you can make it to that fern. All right, let's give it a go.
Fell right off. And I bet most people think they can just get on and ride it, right?
Right. I've actually taken this bicycle all over the world, and I do this what I'm doing right now. I show people the bike, and I say, ride it 10 feet. Nobody can do it. Especially the big macho guys. They're like, of course I can do it. And of course, later after the show, they almost kill themselves trying, right? It actually took me 8 months to learn how to ride this bicycle.
Just to prove that you can ride this bicycle.
I think you understand. I think you understand how my brain works. Yeah, so the way this works, go ahead and kick the kickstand there, Sean. So the way it works is I instantly realized when Barney the welder, he had me on this bike, and I realized how difficult it was. It was a personal challenge because I understood that I had a certain way of thinking, and I had been thinking the same way my entire life. I realized at that moment I had to build a bike, and I had to figure out how to ride it, and it took me 8 months to do that.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. All right, let's see you ride this. Okay. Would you want to see him ride this bike? Okay. Oh, you see? He's putting a helmet on. That tells you something already.
Yeah, the Space and Rocket Center want me to wear a helmet. That's what that tells you. And I'm a rule follower. So,
so we've got about 10 yards of room for you to ride this. Let's see what happens.
Are you going
to
mow my yard for the rest of the summer? If I...
Look at that. Well, he's doing it. Come on, right when you get work. Come on, back. Now you have to work at it though, but you know what to do. It's sort of like pedaling the handlebars.
Well, it's really weird because for the first 5 months, I could get maybe 6 or 7 feet and I'd have a phone in my pocket. And as soon as the phone would ring, I would crash. So it's a brain thing. So the algorithm for riding a bike is way more complicated than I ever thought, because when you push on a pedal, your weight is shifting. And so that's a different input into the equation. I mean, it's crazy. It's very, very difficult. So I don't know. That's it. One thing that's interesting about this, though, is my son had just recently learned how to ride a bike. He was 5 years old. I mean, like, the normal way, right? And so I wanted to experiment and see how good his brain was at adapting to change compared to my brain. And so we built him a bike the same way. And I told him, I was like, look, we're going to go to Australia, and we're going to meet Chris Hadfield, an astronaut. He wants to see if you can ride this bike, right? It took him, what was it, 2 weeks to do the same thing. So it took me 8 months to learn how to ride this backwards bike. It took my 5-year-old 2 weeks. So what does that tell you?
I don't want to go there, believe me.
Very good. Well, what it told me is that younger children have, you know, a totally different type of neuroplasticity than we do.
Yeah, I was just playing with it. I agree with you. It's kids. They have, this is fantastic, Destin. Thank you for bringing the bike. And we're not going to let anybody, I don't think. Well, maybe we'll let a few people in the audience ride the bike. Destin Sandlin is creator of the YouTube science series Smarter Every Day. He's also a missile flight test engineer. So what? Here in Huntsville, Alabama.
It's all about
Thanks
cats
again,
and
Destin,
chickens.
For joining us. And you can watch Destin ride this reverse bike in the new video and watch all the videos we talk about today if you go to our website, sciencefriday.com/smarter-every-day.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have. I'd like to give a special shout out to everyone at Huntsville Public Radio, especially Brett Tannehill and Carl Sampieri, and Roy Clem and Phil Hutchison, and all the folks at Alabama Public Television as APT celebrates its 60th anniversary this year. And our friends here at U.S. Space and Rocket Center, including Dr. Deborah Barnhart, Chris Brothers, and Tim Hall. And of course, Microwave Dave and Jim Cavender on the guitars. Special thanks to Bob Isaacson and our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And to Redstone Federal Credit Union for all their support. And we can't forget our Science Friday staff, Charles Berquist, Jen Connor, Daniel Dana, Brandon Ector, Jennifer Fennick, Becky Fogel, Sarah Goldfarb, Luke Graskin, Christopher Taliata, Jen Kwok, Julie Leibach, Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Annie Nero, Christian Scotta, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. In Huntsville, Alabama, I'm Ira Flato.